persons.
Good morning, Your Honor. Counsel, please the court. I am Dick Parsons, a federal defender for the Central District of Illinois. I represent Mr. Powers. Your Honor, as I prepared for oral argument, the thing that struck me the most was the fact that this was a case, a RICO case, that had 800 hours of tapes, 21,000 pages of documents, and 6 volumes of grand jury testimony, and that my office only had 6 months to prepare for trial. All the other people you're going to hear from today for the defense had at least 3 years. The government had 7 years. I argued, of course, this part of the brief, or in this part of the brief, I direct the court's attention to pages 30 through 37 and the two motions for continuances, which set forth under deposit are very good reasons why we needed more time to prepare for this case, in which the court saw fit to summarily deny without so much as a reason why. That having been said, I believe that we were denied.
One reason might be that we had told the district court in no uncertain terms that this case was to go to trial forthwith.
Well, Your Honor, that, with all due respect, that's very nice, but fair trial is still, I would think, would take more precedence over whether or not it should be done forthwith. We came in as a favor.
Let me amend it. We had told the district court in no uncertain terms that the case was to go to trial forthwith, at the insistence of the defendants, including Powers.
Well, then, excuse me, Your Honor, well, let me put it this way. What happened, in which maybe the court isn't aware of, is that on the eve of trial, Mr. Powers' attorney was removed from the case.
Right. I understand that, and you were substituted, and we actually greatly appreciate your willingness to take this out of your ordinary district.
You know, thank you, Your Honor, because having, you know, hindsight is 20/20. If I would have known then the buzzsaw that I was getting into, I don't think I would have been so polite about coming up here. But in any event, I did not know what you just told me, Your Honor. However, we weren't prepared, and it really doesn't take away from that. But, you know, for the sake of argument, all right, we weren't prepared. But in regard to the Swan case, in the theory of defense instruction, we were prepared as far as that went. I based my whole defense on the holding of this court in Swan. Of the 34 predicate acts in the indictment, our client was named in 10, four of which he was a probate, or if you will, like a pledge in a fraternity. He didn't get to go to the meetings. He had nothing to do with the management or the operation of the organization. The three acts, he was definitely, or if I would have had time to prepare a case in chief, I would have shown that the chop shop, the counterfeiting, the selling of drugs were independent contractor acts and not on behalf of the organization. The other four predicate acts were certainly not in any way, shape, or form things that Mr. Powers had done as a manager of the organization, merely as a member. Now, the Grimes case and the Edwards case from this court say that if, or stand for the principle that if we did anything in the trial that brought into evidence the fact that, in this case, that Mr. Powers was not a manager or an operator, then we were entitled to a Swan-like instruction. The court refused to give that instruction. As a matter of fact, it said that our instruction was confusing when, in fact, it stated almost verbatim this court's ruling in Swan 1. Later, this court, changed Swan only to clarify it so that it wasn't cumulative. But still,
but it was different.
Excuse me.
Swan was different. You relied on a different standard than Swan 2, right?
No, sir.
And your defense?
No, sir.
So you think that as far as your defense would have been or whatever under Swan, didn't matter whether it was Swan 1 or 2.
Correct, because Swan 2 just clarified it. I think our statement of the law under Swan 1, which was the law when we offered it, Swan 2 didn't come until later.
Right.
The problem was, Judge Manion, is that this court hadn't decided Swan during the trial of all the defendants, or most of the defendants except Powers, until after that case was over and ours started. And when I saw that, I remember reading all the law review articles, all the law concerning Reeves, and hallelujah, this is the defense, and then I was shot down until then Swan came along. And then again, once again, I was very happy about the fact that I had a defense. My client wasn't involved in the management. So then we presented that defense based on Swan, the defense to the RICO charges. Then the court, after our trial was over, came down with Swan 2. But to answer your question directly, Judge Manion, I believe that it didn't matter that the Swan 2 said operation or management, and it shouldn't be cumulative and management and operation and so on, so it would be confusing. And our instruction that we offered, and we not only as a the proper law on the question of RICO, but also on the question of our defense, our theory of defense, which is out-handedly denied, just like the motions to continue were denied without any reason. There are no other questions.
Does anything turn on the Swan issue other than the $100 special assessment? And given the RICO conspiracy conviction, what difference does that issue make practically?
Your Honor, practically speaking, until you told me today that it was this order for this court to proceed, I would have said, well, we weren't prepared, and it doesn't, you know, it affects all the charges, the conspiracy as well as the RICO charge. And now to say, you know, does it make any difference? No, probably the result would be is what happened in Swan 1. In the original Swan case, if you were to grant a reversal on Swan, the conspiracy conviction would be upheld unless the court were, and I say it was tongue-in-cheek, enlightened and realized that we weren't prepared for trial because we only had 6 months instead of the 3 years that everyone else had. But the Apprendi...
By the way, has your client paid the $100 special assessment?
I really don't know, Your Honor. And in regard to the Apprendi issue that we raised, it's almost like this whole case from our position anyway, and my client's position was cursed from the beginning. After we wrote the brief, I thought, gee whiz, what a nice argument the Apprendi issue is. Then Cotton came down in between the time that we wrote the brief and today's oral argument, which pretty much robbed it. But again, that's why when I prepared for oral argument, I thought, you know, the thing that strikes me about the whole thing is that you can't, no matter what the standing of the law is, it doesn't matter if you haven't had time to prepare. We didn't. And if there are no other questions...
Well, of course, you were severed, and everybody else complains about not being severed. So for whatever advantage that was, at least you had that.
I don't think it was really that much of an advantage, Your Honor. I think that we would have hidden like Mr. Strang did in the court. he did very well. Our guy was a probate. He was a pledge. He didn't really have anything to do with the operation of the...
Until he got his SS credentials.
That's correct. And later on, he became part of it. But at that point, he still didn't have anything to do with the management, Judge.
How many days did it take to try the case, Mr.
Parsons? It was close to a month. I mean, we were in Milwaukee about a month, a little less in actual days. I think we took Fridays off, Judge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Campbell.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Scott Campbell. I'm an Assistant United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, and I represent the Appellee, United States of America, in this appeal. Your Honors, I'll address first the issue as to whether defense counsel was prepared to try this case and second the Swan issues. The government intends to rely upon the remainder, intends to rely upon its brief for the remaining issues. But first,
do you know, by the way, whether Powers has paid the $100?
Your Honor, I don't know. But I'd be happy to look into it and advise the court by a letter after this.
Because otherwise it's awfully hard to see why the Swan issue matters. But anyway, go ahead.
That's a good point, Your Honor, and I'll go out of order and just address that issue first, and then I'll go to the issue of preparation. Your Honor is absolutely correct that just as this court ruled in Swan, even if this court were to somehow find that Mr. Powers did not, in fact, operate and manage the enterprise for the purpose of substantive liability under Section 1962C, because operation or management is simply not a factor when it comes to racketeering conspiracy, that is, as this court has pointed out, one may conspire to commit racketeering acts through an enterprise without being an operator or a manager. Even if you were to prevail on this issue when it comes to count one, the substantive count, it has nothing to do with count two, the RICO conspiracy charge, so that would stand even if this argument on appeal had merit.
Unless, of course, we were to agree with the Ninth Circuit.
Excuse me?
Unless, of course, we were to agree with the Ninth Circuit.
Heaven forbid. But, in fact, as the court well knows, this same result obtained in the Swan case. But, of course, the government doesn't concede that there was any failure of proof or any problem with the Swan jury instruction in this case. For the simple matter is that the instruction at issue here was very different from the instruction at issue in Swan, as Judge Mannion's question suggested earlier. But in terms of the issue of whether counsel was prepared, as the court well knows, this issue was not raised on appeal. If one looks at the table of contents and the statements of issues that Mr. Powers raised on appeal, nowhere in those five issues did Mr. Powers suggest ineffective assistance of counsel or a simple inability to prepare for his trial. And in fact, the record would undermine any such claim, even if this issue had been properly raised. The court should bear in mind that Mr. Powers,
in the text of his brief, mentioned the fact that his motion for continuance was denied and he didn't have enough time.
He did raise that, but he didn't frame it as an issue, Judge. And I believe he raised it as an adjunct to the Swan issue, principally. So it is not a standalone issue in any event, Your Honor. But in any event, that argument fails on the merits for the simple reason that Mr. Powers was ably represented by three attorneys who had 6 months to prepare for a trial that took, as I understand it, about 2.5 weeks of actual trial time. That certainly was, 6 months was certainly enough time to prepare for this case. Additionally, this case was zealously litigated, and it was litigated well in the trial court, just as it was well briefed on appeal. But the issue of whether counsel was prepared is simply not an issue before this court, except perhaps as an adjunct to the Swan issue. But if counsel is contending that had they had more time, they would have done a better job showing that Mr. Powers was not an operator or manager, I would suggest that defense fails out of the box because the record amply demonstrates that Mr. Powers, in no uncertain terms, operated the enterprise. This is a man who, after all, under the direction of Kevin O'Neill.
If it's so clear, why all this struggle to avoid the holding in Swan? Why not just give a simple instruction in the language of RICO,
Your Honor,
rather than adding stuff to dilute it down?
I agree. If the question is whether this instruction was legally sufficient, the answer is quite plainly yes, because Reeves and Swan stand for the simple proposition that the jury need merely be instructed that in order to be found guilty of substantive racketeering, the defendant must have played some part in operating or managing the enterprise. That instruction was given here. The instruction provided that a person conducts or participates in the conduct of the affairs of an enterprise if that person uses his position in or association with the enterprise to perform acts which are involved in some way in the operation.
That's the problem, involved in some way. A secretary who types a letter is involved in some way in the operation or management of the enterprise, especially if you type it for the president of the enterprise. Think the secretary is guilty under RICO?
No, and Your Honor, that's...
But then we've got a problem with this instruction, because this instruction says the secretary is guilty under RICO.
When the instruction is viewed outside the context of all the instructions, the court might reach for an issue. But I suggest, Your Honor, that if you look at the elements instruction, that dispels it, because the elements instruction, of course, provided that one would be guilty only if he used his position in or association with the enterprise to perform acts that are involved in some way in the operation or management of the enterprise. But that's part of a bigger instruction that says that you must conduct or participate in the conduct of the enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity. The secretary in your example, Your Honor, even if she were a member of the enterprise, she would not be participating in a pattern of racketeering activity. So the issue that one could satisfy this sub-element by being a mere secretary or janitor, I think, misses the point, because the secretary would still need to participate in a pattern of racketeering activity to become guilty of substantive racketeering. Additionally, Your Honor, I suggest this language is thoroughly consistent with both language of the statute, Section 1962C, as well as the Supreme Court's language in Reeves. After all, in Section 1962C, the court pointed out, or in Section 1962C, rather, the statute provides that one need merely conduct or participate directly or indirectly in the conduct of the enterprise's affairs. So that direct or indirect already suggests that this is to be given a broad scope. Additionally, Your Honor, I point out that in Reeves, the Supreme Court pointed out that one need merely play some part in directing the enterprise's affairs. In fact, at page 179 of the United States, at 179 of 507 United States Reporter, the Supreme Court pointed out twice that one need merely play some part in directing the enterprise's affairs. So, Your Honor, I suggest that the language in some way is thoroughly consistent with the directly or indirectly language of the statute, as well as the some part language of the Supreme Court's decision in Reeves. And, Your Honor, I'd like to respond to your question further, Judge Easterbrook, and point out that this instruction, if the question is whether this instruction is legally sufficient, the answer is yes. If the question is could the instruction be improved, the answer is also yes. I would suggest that the pattern instruction, which, of course, the district court did use here, could be improved by adding the following sentence. A person who performs an act involved in the operation of the enterprise when he knowingly performs that act at the direction of the enterprise's upper management. That is,
I'm inclined to think it can be improved by saying fewer things. Isn't this one of these cases where it makes more sense just to charge the jury in the statutory language? It's hard to see how any effort to elaborate can do more than make it worse. Like trying to define reasonable doubt just goes downhill.
Well, again, if the question is whether the jury was adequately instructed on the law, the answer is yes. The jury did, of course, receive an instruction defining, setting forth the statutory language of Section 1962C. Spare language might be better, but the language here was sufficient. And it was not at all like the language in Swan, because, of course, in Swan, the district court did not instruct the jury on the operation or management test. In fact, this court ruled in Swan that the defect in that language was that the jury would have had no idea that operation or management was even an element of a 1962C offense. Here, the jury got that idea very plainly. And, of course, including the operation or management language is safe because the Supreme Court has already passed on it in Reeves. In Reeves, the court stated that the operation or management test is an effective way of conveying the direction requirement. So, Your Honor, I suggest that the language is certainly consistent with the statutory language and with the language of Reeves, but if the question is, could it be improved? Perhaps. But I think that the problem with instructing the jury in the manner that Mr. Powers had proposed in his theory of defense instruction is this. The second sentence of his proposed instruction, which the district court rejected and which he appeals, provided that, in other words, he must have participated in the operation or management of the enterprise itself, and he must have asserted some control over the enterprise. This, of course, is the same sort of conjunctive language that this court had a problem with when it came to the Swan opinion. This is, of course, the very reason why this court superseded and later amended the Swan opinion to remove this language that appeared to create a cumulative burden. The bottom line is that in this case, Mr. Powers contends that he was prejudiced because had the jury been otherwise instructed, it might have concluded that when he committed two murders, when he participated in two murder conspiracies, when he participated in two car bombings, the jury might well have found that he was not operating the enterprise or participating in the conduct of the enterprise because he was simply following Kevin O'Neill's instructions. It's almost like a Nuremberg-type defense. But that simply has no, that simply is inconsistent with the law of this court. To the extent that Mr. Powers contends...
It didn't work at Nuremberg either.
That's right. To the extent that Mr. Powers complains that this jury instruction creates the impression that lower-rung members of an enterprise may be subject to RICO liability, the instruction is absolutely correct. He simply has no complaint in that regard because this court has made clear in several opinions, including MCM Partners and others, that lower-rung members of a racketeering enterprise who implement the decisions of upper management are participating in the operation of the enterprise. So the bottom line is that the fundamental premise of Mr. Powers' complaint about the instruction is simply off point because this court has long recognized that lower-rung members, as he was for a time, are subjected to RICO liability. Indeed, to rule otherwise would really be to eviscerate RICO because, Judge, if you're about to ask a question, would be really be to eviscerate RICO because, of course, an organization like the Outlaws organization would not have been as frighteningly lethal as it was had it not been for people like Kevin O'Neill, who acted as upper management and directed the hits being made, and also if it weren't for people like Harvey Powers, who were the foot soldiers for some time, to make sure those hits were done. After all, when Lamont Mathias was murdered down in Rockford, Illinois, Harvey Powers is the man who got the instructions along with David Wolfe from Kevin O'Neill to get through the hit. He got guns, although not the guns used in the murder. He drove down to Rockford. He encouraged David Wolfe to commit the murder. After the murder was done, he helped melt down the gun. He reported to Kevin O'Neill, and as a reward for his participation in this murder, he got his SS designation. Plainly, the enterprise appreciated what he did. By receiving that SS, Harvey Powers, in effect, acknowledged the appreciation the organization had for the hit he did for the organization. When he did that, he was quite plainly doing the organization's bidding, and in that sense, he was participating in the operation of the enterprise. Therefore, Your Honor, there is no problem when it comes to the Swan instruction, and as applied to this case, it is abundantly clear that Mr. Powers did participate in the operation of the enterprise. For our remaining points, we rely upon our brief unless the court has any questions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Parsons?
Words murder, tornado, rattlesnake, all those things are meant to inflame. And thank God that assistant U.S. attorney was talking to three learned jurists who understand the law rather than a jury. Because that had nothing, the fact that those things occurred, that have nothing to do with the management of the enterprise. And, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook, I misspoke. It is my wont in life, I'm afraid. When you said...
Faith of all of
it. Yes, I do that a lot. Too bad. But in any event, Your Honor, when you said this court told the district court to proceed post-haste, I thought perhaps you were talking about administratively. And, in fact, you were talking about warranty.
Yes, our public...
And, yes,
public
and it was my mistake, Your Honor. In warranty, what happened after Mr. Powers was severed, according to the ruling of this court in warranty, the magistrate judge did release, or set bond, I should say, for Mr. Powers. And then, once again, the district court overruled that and put Mr. Powers back in jail so that we couldn't meet with him. But... he then waived any speedy trial rights that he may have had, Your Honor. So I misspoke when I said I thought perhaps there was an administrative, but you were referring to warranty. And our brief pretty much covers that, Your Honor. In regard to an assistant U.S. attorney saying that when they had 7 years to prepare for this trial, and 6 months was more than enough for us, that's balderdash. And that shouldn't even be taken seriously. It's defense lawyers. I've been doing this for over 40 years, and it's the first time in 40-some years I've ever come to this court and complained that I didn't have time to be prepared, and that a motion for continuance wasn't granted, a proper motion for continuance. Here are two of them were summarily denied, and thank you, Judge Connie, for noticing. Yes, we did argue it. It was part of a procedure or a pattern, if you will, of let's rush to judgment, let's rush to trial, and let everything else be damned. The instruction that was given was confusing. If you just read that instruction compared to the one that we offered, it's confusing. It didn't state the law as was in effect at that time. And I believe this, Your Honors, that before we put a man in prison for the rest of his life, he should have a fair opportunity to defend himself. And this opportunity doesn't exist when his counsel is denied the opportunity to prepare. And I ask this court to give Mr. Powers the opportunity for a fair trial, reverse his convictions, and remand this trial, or this case, for a new trial.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Parsons, again, we thank you particularly for your willingness to accept this out of your usual stamping ground.
Thanks, Judge.
The case is taken under advisement.